All right, welcome to your deep dive, all about the archaeology of the kingdoms of Israel and Judah.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to be looking at what happened after the reigns of David and Solomon when things kind of went south.
Yeah.
So specifically, we'll be using Dr. Jeffrey Hoonan's lectures on biblical archaeology to kind of guide our way.
Excellent source.
Yeah, so get ready to explore not just the historical events, but we're also going to be looking at theological perspectives from the Bible.
Absolutely.
And some really cool archaeological finds.
I think you'll be fascinated to see how some of these ancient stories actually have a lot to say about what's going on in the world today.
Hmm. So you mentioned things going south.
Yeah.
This split sounds pretty dramatic. What happened at Shechem?
Okay, so picture this. You're Rehoboam,
okay,
Solomon's son. You just inherited the throne. And you're at Shechem meeting with all the elders of the 12 tribes.
Mm-hmm.
And they come to you with a whole list of complaints. They're basically saying, listen, your dad's taxes and all the labor he was demanding, it was just too much.
Yeah.
If you want us to stay loyal, you've got to lighten up.
No. It's a reasonable request.
Totally. But Rehoboam, well, he doesn't exactly handle it well. He's like, my little finger is thicker than my father's waist.
Oh, wow.
You think his demands were tough? I'll make them even worse.
Sounds like he had a bit of an ego problem.
Oh, yeah. Major arrogance, terrible judgment, you know, not the best PR move.
That's putting it mildly. So that's what caused the whole kingdom to split.
That was kind of the last straw.
Mm.
10 of the tribes decide, okay, we're out of here.
Wow.
They follow Jeroboam and they form the kingdom of Israel in the north.
Okay.
Then you've got Judah and Benjamin sticking with Rehoboam and the Davidic dynasty down in the south.
Okay, the kingdom of Judah.
Exactly. And it's interesting because this whole event kind of highlights the different ways the Bible looks at theology.
Oh.
So you've got the Book of Kings written earlier.
Mm-hmm.
It presents this idea of delayed retribution, the sins of the fathers impacting their kids and even future generations.
Like a ripple effect.
Yeah, exactly. But then you've got Chronicles written later.
Yeah.
And it's got this more immediate, like instant karma vibe.
Oh, interesting.
Immediate consequences for your actions.
Makes you think, how did those different views affect how they saw things happening around them?
Yeah. And it's something we deal with today, too, right? Trying to understand why things happen the way they do.
Absolutely.
How much do our own biases and interpretations shape the way we see history, current events, even our own personal experiences?
Definitely something to think about.
For sure.
Okay, so now we have this divided kingdom. Tensions are running high. And then, boom, Shishak, the Pharaoh of Egypt, decides to launch a raid on both Israel and Judah.
Right.
But here's where it gets interesting. Jeroboam, the first king of the northern kingdom, he'd actually sought refuge in Egypt under this very same Shishak.
Mm, that is interesting. Maybe there's some history there that we don't know about.
Yeah, some ancient political drama. Do we have any evidence of Shishak's raid other than what's in the Bible?
Oh, absolutely. You can actually go see it for yourself on the wall of the Karnak Temple in Egypt.
Okay.
There are these engravings, and they list nearly 200 cities and forts that Shishak conquered.
Like his personal victory list.
Exactly, like bragging rights carved in stone.
But how do we know he wasn't exaggerating? Maybe it's just propaganda.
That's where the archaeology comes in.
Right.
They've been doing excavations at some of their sites listed on that inscription, and they're finding evidence of destruction that lines up with Shishak's reign.
So he wasn't messing around.
No, he was definitely making a statement.
He wreaked havoc. What was his goal, though? Plunder, power, just to mess with them.
Probably a bit of everything.
Makes sense.
Actually, you mentioned in your research that you were wondering about the fate of the treasures from Solomon's temple.
I was.
Well, a prominent scholar, Alan Millard, he suggested that some of those treasures may have made their way to Egypt.
Really? How's that possible?
So when they excavated the tombs of Shishak's successors, they found a ridiculous amount of gold and riches, more than you'd normally expect for pharaohs of that time.
Okay.
And Millard's theory is that a good chunk of it could be loot from Jerusalem.
That's amazing. Is there any way to prove that, though? Or is it just a theory? Could there be more discoveries waiting to be made that could maybe answer that?
It's definitely an area that needs more research, for sure. Who knows what else they might find?
Okay. Back to Rehoboam in Judah. Things aren't looking good for him.
No, not really.
Chronicles mentions that he fortified a bunch of cities, but why? Was it to defend against outside threats like Shishak, or was he more worried about keeping his own kingdom from falling apart?
That's the million-dollar question, and archaeologists are still trying to figure it out.
Huh.
Problem is, many of the sites mentioned in Chronicles haven't really given us much from Rehoboam's time.
Really?
There have been some digs, but nothing definitive.
So does that lack of evidence then lend more weight to the idea that he was more concerned with internal control? If it was about external threats, you'd think there'd be more fortifications along the borders, right?
It's possible. Yeah, maybe those fortifications were more for show than anything else.
Okay.
A way to project an image of strength and stability when things were actually pretty shaky.
I see.
Of course, there's always a chance they'll find something new that could change everything. That's what's so cool about archaeology.
True. The mystery continues. Amazing to think about all the things we still don't know.
It's a constant process of discovery.
All right, let's head north now to the kingdom of Israel.
All right.
Jeroboam, the first king, he wasn't just sitting around.
Definitely not.
He was making some pretty strategic moves to solidify his power.
He was a smart guy.
Yeah, like establishing sanctuaries at Dan and Bethel.
Oh, yeah, two very important religious sites.
Was that a power move? To kind of rival Jerusalem and its religious authority?
Bingo. Jeroboam knew that to control people, he had to control their religious practices. By creating alternative religious centers, he could lessen Jerusalem's influence and strengthen his own position.
Smart. And you mentioned in your lectures that while Bethel hasn't been excavated, Dan has been partially restored.
Right. And it's amazing to see. It gives you a real glimpse into how they practiced religion back then.
You got to wonder what treasures might be hidden under the ground at Bethel.
Oh, I'm sure there's something there.
Speaking of traitors, Samaria, the capital of the Northern Kingdom, it became quite grand, especially during the Jehu dynasty.
It did. A real show of wealth and power.
Yeah, they even had their own distinct style of pottery, Samaria ware.
Beautiful stuff. Really well made.
But not everyone was enjoying the good times, right?
Yeah.
The prophet Amos had some strong words for the elites in Samaria.
Oh, yeah. He was calling them out for their extravagance while others were suffering.
Right. You mentioned in your lecture that he was a powerful voice for social justice.
He was.
His message even resonates today.
It does. He was basically saying, hey, true prosperity isn't just about economic growth. It's about making sure everyone benefits.
It's a challenge we still face today, finding that balance between economic success and social justice.
Absolutely. It's about leadership, about making sure those with power use it responsibly.
Powerful stuff.
It is.
So Samaria, did it listen to Amos's warnings?
Unfortunately, no.
Oh.
Despite all its wealth and sophistication, Samaria eventually fell to the Assyrians in 722 BC.
And that was the end of the Northern Kingdom.
It was a tragic end, a real turning point.
And this is where we get that story of the 10 lost tribes, right?
Yes, the lost tribes.
But you were quick to point out in your lectures that they weren't actually lost.
Right. Lost is a bit of a misnomer.
Okay.
We know from historical records and archaeology that they were deported to Assyria and ended up assimilating into the culture there.
So not lost, just absorbed.
Exactly. History is often more complicated than the stories we tell.
That's for sure. Now, before we move on, I want to hear about some of those cool artifacts you mentioned, those volut capitals.
Oh, they're amazing.
Found not just in Israel and Judah, but also among their neighbors, the Ammonites and Moabites.
Right.
What do these shared architectural elements tell us?
Well, they tell us that there was a lot of cultural exchange going on, more than just simple trade or diplomacy.
Okay.
They suggest a kind of shared artistic sense, maybe even a common architectural language that went beyond political differences.
So despite their conflicts, they were borrowing ideas and styles from each other.
Absolutely. They were influencing each other all the time, blending different traditions together.
That's so cool. It really paints a different picture.
It does. It shows that these ancient societies weren't static. They were constantly evolving, adapting, picking up new ideas.
Makes you wonder what else they were sharing and how much more interconnected they were than we often think.
Right. It's exciting to think about.
Now, those pillar figurines found almost exclusively in Judah.
Yes, those are intriguing.
They often depict women. And you said they've sparked a lot of debate among scholars.
Oh, absolutely. Are they fertility goddesses? Are they connected to Asherah, a Canaanite goddess? It's a mystery.
These ancient objects, they really make you think.
They do. They challenge our assumptions.
And they remind us that these societies weren't just one big homogenous group. There was diversity in beliefs and practices, even within a single kingdom.
Exactly. It's important to remember that.
Now, those stunning ivories they found in Samaria.
Oh, those are exquisite.
You mentioned how the prophet Amos condemned the luxury of the Israelite elites.
Mm-hmm. He wasn't impressed.
Were those ivories a reflection of that excess?
Oh, without a doubt.
Wow.
Those ivories with scenes of banquets and processions, they scream wealth and status.
They must have been pretty valuable.
They were, and they were often imported from faraway places like Phoenicia.
So these ivories, they're not just beautiful works of art, they're also evidence of the social and economic gaps that existed in the Northern Kingdom.
Exactly. And it's fascinating to think about how differently people would have viewed those objects.
Right.
For the elite, they were symbols of power.
Yeah.
But for Amos, they were a sign of a society that had lost its way, that had put material wealth ahead of things like justice and compassion.
The stark contrast, those different perspectives.
And it's a reminder that objects can have multiple meanings depending on who's looking at them.
And what their values are.
Exactly.
Now, shifting gears a bit, let's talk about the Battle of Kwarkwar in 853 BC.
Right.
Why was this battle so important?
Well, it was a huge battle, one of the biggest and most decisive in the ancient Near East.
Wow.
It involved a coalition of kingdoms, including Israel and Judah.
Okay.
And they teamed up to resist the Assyrian Empire, which was getting pretty powerful.
So a real clash of titans.
Yeah. You've got the mighty Assyrian army against this diverse group determined to protect their independence.
What's interesting is you mentioned that this battle, which took place in northern Syria, isn't even mentioned in the Book of Kings.
It's strange, isn't it?
It is. Why do you think they left it out?
Maybe they were trying to downplay it. Perhaps it didn't end so well for them. Or maybe they just didn't have all the details.
Makes sense.
Whatever the reason, it shows how important it is to look at multiple sources when we're trying to understand the past.
Right. We can't just rely on one narrative.
Especially when it comes to things that are politically or religiously charged.
So even back then, there was spin and bias.
Oh, yeah. And our job is to try to see through that and get as close to the truth as we can.
It's like a detective story.
It is.
Now, King Ahab, he met a pretty dramatic end at the Battle of Ramoth-Gilead.
He did.
What can you tell us about that battle?
Well, it was another example of the struggle between Israel and Judah and their neighbors. Ahab, the king of Israel, joined forces with Jehoshaphat, the king of Judah.
So they were working together for once.
They were. They were trying to recapture this strategic city from the Arameans.
Yay.
Unfortunately for Ahab, it didn't go well.
What happened?
He was fatally wounded by an arrow, a stray arrow.
Wow. Talk about bad luck.
It's a reminder that even kings weren't invincible. True, it really shows how individual lives can be caught up in these larger historical events.
And you mentioned that the site of that battle, Tel Urumith, it's being built over.
Sadly, yes.
It makes you realize how fragile these ancient places are.
It does.
And how important it is to preserve what we can.
Absolutely.
Okay, let's talk about Jehoshaphat, one of the big kings of Judah.
Okay.
He had quite the showdown with Moab, Edom, and Ammon.
Oh, yeah, that was a wild one.
According to the Bible, their armies just turned on each other.
I know, right?
Leaving the Judeans to just scoop up the spoils of war.
Easy victory.
But then there's the Mishastel, which tells a different story.
Right. Imagine reading an account of a war and then finding the enemy's version. That's what the Mishastel is.
So we're getting the Moabite side of things.
Exactly. And it reminds us that history is often told from the winner's point of view.
Good point.
But thanks to archaeology, we sometimes get to hear the other side.
The Mishastel is one of the most studied ancient texts. What does it tell us about the political situation back then?
It's like a window into that world. It shows us the complex web of alliances, the rivalries, the power struggles.
It was a messy time.
It was. And the Mishastel gives us the Moabite perspective, their own version of the conflict.
So there's always more than one side to the story.
Always.
And we have to consider them all.
Absolutely.
You also mentioned that we have to be careful about forgeries in archaeology.
Oh, yeah. It's a real problem.
You brought up the Joash tablet, which supposedly talks about repairs to the temple by King Joash.
Right. But most scholars think it's a fake.
Oh, wow. So how can you tell?
Well, it just appeared on the antiquities market. No one knows where it came from.
That's suspicious.
Very suspicious.
It's a good reminder to be critical of what we see and read.
It is. Not everything is what it seems.
Especially when it comes to ancient stuff.
Exactly.
It makes you wonder what other forgeries are out there.
I'm sure there are plenty. It's a constant battle to weed them out.
So we've covered a lot of ground here.
We have.
Rebellions, artifacts, even hints of treasure.
It's been quite a journey.
What stands out to you as the most significant takeaway from all of this?
You know, I think the biggest lesson is that history is never simple.
Right.
These kingdoms were complex. They faced so many challenges.
Internal strife, political instability, powerful empires breathing down their necks.
Exactly. But they kept going. They adapted. They left behind this incredible cultural legacy.
It's inspiring. in a way.
It is. It shows the resilience of the human spirit.
Even in the midst of chaos, there's creativity.
And that's a message we need to remember today.
Absolutely.
By studying the past, we can learn so much about ourselves and the world we live in.
It gives us perspective.
It does.
And maybe even some hope.
I think so.
Now, I know we've been focusing on the big picture, the kings, the battles.
Mm-hmm.
But what about the everyday people who live through all of this?
Ah, the unsung heroes of history.
Right. What was it like for them?
Well, their stories are often hidden, but they're there if you know where to look.
Okay, I'm intrigued.
It's like a puzzle waiting to be solved.
I like that.
And sometimes the smallest details can tell us the most amazing things.
I can't wait to hear more.
Well, let's dive in.
Okay, let's start with someone who's often portrayed as a villain, Queen Jezebel.
Ah, Jezebel, a fascinating and controversial figure.
The Bible paints her as pretty ruthless.
It does.
But you've mentioned before that there might be more to her story.
Right. We have to remember that history is often written by the winners.
And in this case.
Well, those who wrote the biblical accounts, they had a very specific agenda.
Correct.
They were promoting Yahwistic monotheism, the idea that Yahweh was the one true God.
Right.
Jezebel was a Phoenician princess.
Huh.
She brought her own religion and cultural practices with her.
And that wouldn't have gone over well.
Not at all. It would have been seen as a threat to their whole belief system.
So is it possible that her story was twisted to make her look bad, to justify getting rid of her and her dynasty?
It's definitely a possibility.
Hmm. It makes you wonder how many other historical figures have been misrepresented.
I'm sure there are many. It's our job to dig deeper and question what we're told.
That's what we're here for. So what if Jezebel was actually a strong, independent woman who just refused to conform?
Right. What if she was a skilled politician just trying to protect her own interests and those of her people?
It's like those old stories are still speaking to us today, telling us to be critical thinkers, to challenge assumptions.
Exactly.
There's always more to the story than we initially see.
That's what makes history so exciting.
It's a constant process of discovery, of challenging our own preconceptions.
And expanding our understanding of what it means to be human.
We've covered a lot in this deep dive.
We have.
Political intrigue, religious conflict, amazing discoveries, and the stories of people both big and small.
It's been a whirlwind tour.
It really has. What would you say is the most lasting impact of this period in history?
For me, it's the resilience of the human spirit. They faced incredible challenges, internal divisions, external threats, and yet they found ways to adapt and survive.
And to create.
Exactly.
They left behind a cultural legacy that we're still talking about today.
Thousands of years later.
It's incredible.
It is.
It shows that even in the darkest of times, human creativity finds a way to shine through.
And that's a powerful message, especially in the world we live in today.
It is, and it gives us hope.
Absolutely.
Hope that we can overcome our own challenges and leave behind something meaningful for future generations.
I agree. The past can teach us so much if we're willing to listen.
Thank you for joining us on this incredible journey through the archaeology of the divided kingdoms. We hope you've enjoyed this deep dive and that it's inspired you to keep exploring the fascinating world of ancient history.
My pleasure. It's always a joy to share these stories.
Welcome back to our deep dive into the archaeology of the divided kingdoms. Last time we talked about the split, Shishak's raid, and some incredible artifacts. I was really struck by how much cultural exchange was happening, even though they were politically divided.
Yeah, it really shows they weren't totally isolated. They were part of this larger interconnected world, influencing each other all the time.
We were also talking about the influence of empires on smaller kingdoms. And in this case, Assyria's presence loomed large, right? It must have been a tricky situation to navigate for these smaller kingdoms.
Oh, absolutely. Like walking a tightrope. They were trying to stay independent, but also avoid making the Assyrians angry. A delicate balancing act, for sure.
Well, let's dig into some of those fascinating artifacts that have been unearthed, like those Valuk capitals we talked about. They were found not just in Israel and Judah, but also with their neighbors, the Ammonites and Moabites. What do those shared architectural elements tell us?
Well, it suggests more than just simple trade or diplomacy. They had a shared artistic sense, even maybe a common architectural language that went beyond their political differences.
So they were borrowing ideas,
yeah.
Adapting styles, creating this unique blend of influences.
Exactly. And it reminds us that these societies were constantly evolving, always taking on new ideas and adjusting to new situations.
And talking about artifacts that challenge our assumptions, those pillar figurines found mostly in Judah. You mentioned they often show women, sometimes with exaggerated features. Some people think they're fertility goddesses. Others connect them to Ashra, the Canaanite goddess.
Yeah, they're really interesting because they make us think about how diverse the religious beliefs and practices were in ancient Judah. We don't know for sure. Were they used in homes, in public spaces, in rituals? Were they worshipped, or did they have some other symbolic meaning?
It's like these artifacts are holding on to secrets, giving us clues about the religious landscape of the kingdom.
And we have to remember that they weren't all the same, these ancient societies. Lots of different beliefs and practices could coexist even in one kingdom. The pillar figurines remind us to avoid easy explanations and to look for the complexity in these cultures.
Now let's talk about the incredible ivories found in Samaria. We discussed how the prophet Amos really condemned the luxury and extravagance of the elite Israelites. Were those ivories a sign of that excess?
Oh, absolutely. They often show scenes of banquets, processions, mythological creatures, all these signs of wealth and sophistication, definitely status symbols, carefully crafted and imported from faraway places like Phoenicia.
So they were beautiful art, but also kind of a symbol of the social and economic divides in the Northern Kingdom.
Exactly. And it's interesting to think about how differently those objects would have been seen. For the elites, they were a sign of their power. But for someone like Amos, they were a sign of a society that had lost its moral compass, putting material wealth above things like social justice.
It's a striking contrast, those different points of view.
It reminds us that objects can have different meanings for different people, depending on their own values and beliefs.
Okay, let's switch gears to the political scene. You talked about the Battle of Qarqar in 853 BC. What was so important about it?
Well, it was one of the biggest and most important battles in the ancient Near East, a real clash of civilizations. You had a bunch of kingdoms, including Israel and Judah, teaming up to try and stop the Assyrian Empire, which was getting really powerful.
So it was a fight for survival, a stand against this expanding empire.
Absolutely. But what's really interesting is this battle, which happened in northern Syria, isn't even mentioned in the Book of Kings.
That's weird. Why do you think they left that out?
Maybe they didn't want to talk about it. Maybe it didn't go well for them, or maybe they just didn't know all the details.
It makes you realize how important it is to look at different sources, not just one side of the story.
Right, especially when we're talking about things that are politically or religiously sensitive.
Even back then, they were spinning the story.
Oh, for sure. And our job is to try and figure out what really happened to get as close to the truth as possible.
It's like historical detective work.
It really is.
Now, King Ahab met a pretty dramatic end at the Battle of Ramoth-Gilead. What can you tell us about that?
Well, it was another chapter in this ongoing conflict between Israel and Judah and their neighbors. Ahab, the king of Israel, teamed up with Jehoshaphat, the king of Judah, to try and retake a city from the Arameans.
So for once, they were working together.
Yeah, unusual alliance, but unfortunately for Ahab, things took a bad turn. He got hit by a stray arrow and died.
Just bad luck.
It shows that even kings weren't safe in those days, and it really highlights how individual lives could be changed forever by these big historical events.
And you said the place where that battle happened, Tel Urumith, is being built over now.
Yeah, it's sad, but it's a reminder that these ancient places are fragile, and it's so important to protect the ones we still have.
Okay, let's move on to Jehoshaphat, one of the most important kings of Judah. He had that big fight with Moab, Edom, and Ammon. The Bible says their armies turned on each other, and the Judeans just swooped in and collected the loot.
Pretty convenient victory.
But then there's the Mesha Steel, which tells a different story.
Yeah, the other side of the coin. It's like reading about a war, then finding the enemy's version of what happened.
So we're getting the Moabite perspective.
Exactly. And it reminds us that history is often written by the winners. But archaeology can sometimes give us a glimpse of the other side, the voices that were silenced.
The Mesha Steel is one of the most studied ancient texts, right? What does it tell us about what was going on politically back then?
It really gives us a window into that world. It shows all those complicated relationships, the alliances, the rivalries, the fight for power. The Moabites have their own version of events. They talk about their victories, their struggles against Israel.
So many layers to uncover.
It reminds us that there's always more than one side to every story.
And it's our job to try and put all those pieces together.
Exactly, to look at all the evidence and try to build a more complete picture.
Now, you mentioned that we also have to be careful about fakes in archaeology.
Oh, yeah, forgeries. They're a real headache.
You brought up the Joash tablet, supposedly about repairs to the temple by King Joash.
Right, but a lot of people think it's a fake.
So how can you tell? What makes them suspicious?
Well, it just showed up on the antiquities market one day. Nobody knows where it came from. That's a big red flag.
So always got to be careful. not everything is what it seems.
Definitely. We have to be critical, look for the evidence, rely on experts who can spot the fakes.
Speaking of experts, maybe you can help me with this. We've covered a lot. Rebellions, artifacts, even hints of treasure. What would you say is the most important thing we can take away from all of this?
I think the biggest lesson is that history is never simple. These kingdoms are complicated. They faced all sorts of challenges, but they kept going. They adapted. They left behind this amazing cultural legacy.
It's pretty inspiring when you think about it.
It shows how resilient people can be, even when things are tough. They found ways to be creative and make something new.
And that's a message we can all learn from.
Absolutely. Studying the past can teach us so much about ourselves and the world we live in.
Welcome back to our deep dive. You know, last time we were talking about how the Bible often portrays King Ahab as this wicked king.
Mm-hmm.
And it got me thinking about, you know, all the people who lived through these really turbulent times.
Right.
What was it like for them?
Yeah.
Did they see their leaders as heroes or villains?
That's a great question. You know, we've been focusing on the kings and the battles and the big names.
Right.
But what about just everyday people? The farmers, the artisans?
Right. People just trying to get by.
Yeah, exactly. Their stories don't usually make it into the history books.
They don't.
But they were living through all of this, too.
Right.
And their stories are still out there, hidden in the archaeological record, waiting to be discovered.
So you're saying we can find their stories, even if they didn't write them down?
Absolutely. Sometimes a simple piece of pottery or a child's toy.
Yeah.
It can give us a glimpse into their lives.
Like a window into their world.
Exactly.
You said before that those little details, those everyday objects, they can actually tell us more about a society than the big monuments or inscriptions.
Sometimes.
Yeah.
It's fascinating.
It really is. You know, it's those everyday things, the tools, the clothes, the food.
Right.
That really bring the past to life for me.
Yeah.
They connect us to the people who came before us.
They make those people real.
They do.
They had hopes and dreams and struggles just like us.
Exactly.
Speaking of stories that often get overlooked, what about Queen Jezebel?
Oh, Jezebel.
She's often portrayed as this, I don't know, almost cartoon villain.
Right, a symbol of wickedness.
But is that fair?
Well, the Bible doesn't paint her in a very positive light.
It doesn't. It portrays her as this ruthless queen who promoted the worship of Baal and even had Naboth killed for his vineyard.
It's a pretty dramatic story.
It is, but it's important to remember that those accounts were written from a particular perspective.
Okay.
You know, the people who wrote those stories, they had their own beliefs and their own agenda.
So they might have been biased against her.
It's possible.
Why?
Well, think about it. She was a Phoenician princess.
Right.
She brought her own religion and culture with her.
Which wouldn't have been popular with those who were trying to establish Yahweh as the one true God.
Exactly.
So they might have twisted her story to discredit her and to justify getting rid of her and her whole dynasty.
It's definitely something to consider.
It makes you wonder how we should interpret those ancient stories.
It does. We need to be aware of the biases in our sources and be open to different interpretations.
So, what if Jezebel wasn't this evil queen? What if she was a strong, independent woman who was just trying to hold on to her own beliefs and traditions?
Right. What if she was actually a skilled politician who was just trying to protect her own interests and those of her people?
It's like those ancient stories are still challenging us today.
They are.
They're telling us to think critically, to question what we're told.
To look for the other side of the story.
Because there's always more to it than we might think.
Absolutely.
We've covered so much ground in this deep dive.
We have.
Political intrigue, religious tensions, incredible archaeological discoveries, and stories of kings and queens and everyday people.
It's been a fascinating journey.
It really has. This era was clearly a pivotal moment in the history of Israel and Judah.
A time of great upheaval.
Yeah, but also a time of great creativity.
That's right.
What would you say is the most enduring legacy of this period?
You know, for me, it's the resilience of the human spirit.
Mm.
These kingdoms face so many challenges.
Internal divisions, political instability, those powerful empires always looming in the background. But they persevered. They adapted. They left behind a rich cultural legacy that we're still learning from today.
It's amazing what they accomplished.
It is. It shows that even in the midst of chaos and uncertainty, human creativity finds a way to flourish.
That's a powerful message.
It is, and I think it's especially relevant in today's world.
I agree.
We face our own set of challenges.
We do.
But their story gives us hope.
It does.
Hope that we can overcome those challenges and leave behind something meaningful for future generations.
Absolutely.
Thank you for joining us on this incredible journey through the archaeology of the Divided Kingdom.
It's been my pleasure.
We hope this deep dive has sparked your curiosity and inspired you to keep exploring the fascinating world of ancient history.